maybe familiar to some of you or not to others. I have a kind of a physical viewpoint for this. You know, I'm not a physicist, and I'm also not a biologist, so I'm not exactly sure what I am at this point. So my coworkers, Jack Dockery, and also a couple of graduate students I'll talk about their work a lot. Eric Alquist, who's in the back, and Jai Wan, who's probably on the wall, he's probably on the other side of the wall. Probably be opposite. Okay. I have some other acknowledgments to make. First, my biology collaborators, Phil Stewart and Paul Stubbe, those are the people who tell me what I'm doing right and wrong hopefully. Somebody gave a talk a while back and then said, and thanked his biology coworkers for reminding them of the biology every week, and that's the same thing for me, except I should warn you, I haven't seen them in quite a long time, so my biology might be a little bit rough. And of course, the various people putting together this workshop, I've been here a while, it's a very pleasant place to be, which comes me to the last acknowledgement to my neighbors in shoveling a sidewalk in Oldwinter. I guess there was some snow this week possibly too, so he may even be doing that just keep, without me, but also probably.
Does that mean you couldn't have been here because you would have been snowed in if they hadn't shoveled you out?
Well, maybe I couldn't get back home. But, okay. So I thought I'd spend a bunch of time talking about, just showing pictures basically in movies of biofilms and talking a little bit about what I know about what biofilms are and what they do. And then the story I want to get into today is really the following. What does a biofilm look like over a long period of time? And there's basically two things that go on, and they're not completely disconnected from each other, although I will disconnect them into two different parts of the talk, which is biofilm grows. It's a living object, so it's growing. But of course, it doesn't grow forever, so something stops it from growing forever, and that's mainly chunks of biofilm coming off. So if you want to get kind of the long-term stationary state of the biofilm, you need to combine these two things. And that's the two main parts of this talk. So by stressor, I'm really referring to some outside imposed stress. That's the thing that rips chunks of biofilm off, which will be typically fluid shear stress, which is what I'll talk about, but it could be something. What is a biofilm? It's a collection of microorganisms that get together and self-secrete this matrix of polymers and lots of other stuff. And they stick to a wall or something, and they're nicely protected there, and they're very happy. So these things are found really everywhere. I'll show you a good example in a few minutes. Anywhere where there's water and something to attach to. I've learned that there's not really much known about bacteria, actually. Shockingly little, in fact. But the biofilm people say that most bacteria actually live in biofilms. I don't know if they actually know this for a fact, but that's what they say. And so I like to be dramatic and say that biofilms are the dominant life form on Earth or something like that. Of course, I don't know if that's true, but if it is true, I don't really know what that means. They're very old. They appear very early on in the fossil record, and it kind of makes sense. This is a nice way to protect yourself if you're a bacteria. You can attach to a wall if you found a nice spot, grow in a nice colony there, secrete this stuff, which keeps you attached to the wall and keeps other bugs from coming and eating you very easily.
Could you tell us how they find this if it's a something that has to be fluid and watery and that's a 3.235 billion years ago. How did they find that?
Yeah, I don't know. I actually haven't seen pictures of these fossils, but something's left. This polymer stuff is left behind. It somehow makes some kind of impression.
Is it? How is it so extremely accurately dated?
Well, that I have no idea.
Are you calling a stromatolite a biofilm?
Yes, I think.
Oh, it's a stromatolite.
So that may be the So you'll find these things anywhere where there's water. So obviously there's going to be a lot of applications, medical, industrial applications. Usually you want to get rid of them, but not always. I mentioned most bacterial infections are biofilm related. Cystic fibrosis patients have trouble with biofilm. Burn victims have trouble with biofilm. Anytime you stick anything into your body, stents, catheters, whatever, trouble with biofilm. Heart valves, big problem with artificial hearts is where biofilm is going on. And my interest is really that these things are so interesting, they behave in so many interesting ways. And they're, as materials, they're quite interesting, which is really what I want to talk about today. They're liquid life forms. Okay, so I have some pictures. Let me start off with kind of an anonymous biofilm picture. Just a sea of biofilms, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, picture taken by Paul Stoodley. So you get an idea. This is maybe a bit bumpier than you'll typically see in laboratory biofilms, but this is sort of what they look like. They're not really flat things. So to set our coordinates, there's a wall here, a substratum, and there is a biofilm that grows on the, out from the wall, out this direction, and then typically, for me at least, there'll be a fluid flow going across, somehow like that. I kind of like to turn this over later on, so let me see if I can do that. Somehow it's nicer to think of the biofilm growing from the floor instead of from the ceiling. So my picture will be at this one. So just keep this in mind. This is the view. This is kind of what the picture you should have in your head as we're talking. Okay, so here's a cartoon, which is really based on that picture. And again, it's exaggerated, but another thing to keep in the back of your mind. So this is sort of what people think of as a biofilm. It's already an old picture, but it's okay. It's not changed that much. These little dots are bacteria, and the stuff around is the polymeric matrix. Okay, so you get these, well, they're sort of mushrooms. There's a little history, actually. I think that picture that I just showed a moment ago got a lot of people interested. They saw these mushrooms and started thinking of sort of complicated mechanisms for these to form, and wrote down pictures like this, where you had somehow the bacteria knew that it's better to be this way so they could have channels doing all these sorts of things. And then a bunch of modeling appeared after that, which I'll get into. But anyway, so it's not, things are not really as dramatic as this. You do get bumps, but maybe not typically as mushroomy as this. You do have channels with things flowing, but maybe not as big as these. And this guy here, they call a streamer. It's these things that hang off the ends and kind of flap around. And actually have a big fluid dynamical effect. Picture I like to show. This is taken in Yellowstone National Park. So mostly I just want, it's a nice picture, I just want to show for that reason. But it does have illustrate the point that these things can grow in lots of places. This is in the downwash from a geyser in Biscuit Basin. So this water is extremely hot, somewhere not too far from boiling when it comes through every now and then, and very acidic as well. Nothing growing there except for these sorts of things, which are.
Does this water level go up and down? And except, does that account for those mushroom shapes?
I think that's right.
How big is this?
It's something on the order of a centimeter. So this is huge compared. I should have said this before. This is huge compared to the what we typically see.
But this across the picture is 1 centimeter.
No, up and down.
Oh,
it's on that order. I'm not sure exactly. Yeah.
So these also look like formations you get up in Long Lake or some of them around the lake, and those are a literal process.
Those are big things, right?
Yeah, they're little. But the ones that are thinking of, they're about this tall. So more or less, but they top a lot. They look almost identical.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it'd be for the same reason or not. Those are some sort of depositional thing. these are actually growing in its size.
So this entire thing is a biofilm, and it's not like this is rock covered with a little
bit. No. You can see what the...
In the previous image that you showed, is it air going around the streamers, or is it...
Well, this is
right. In this picture, the biofilm is sticking out into the air, right?
Yeah, but these geysers go off and every now and then, and a lot of water comes out.
I see.
So I think, although I'm not sure that they probably go up to here. So these are big, but let me go back to the pulse picture here. It's important to set the scale as well. This is 100 micron bar here, so the thickness of these things is on the order of 100 microns. So this is not quite microfluidics because this is tens of microns. It's pretty close. Oops. So that's movies. Trying to show. So I'd like to show some movies by Paul Studley to illustrate some of the material properties of these guys. This is a biofilm, probably Pseudomonas aeruginosa again, I'm not sure. The surface is here, so the biofilm's up here. There's a flow coming in from this side. So you can see everything. And so what he does is he turns the flow on and off, and off, and I'll loop the movie, so it's a little hard to see that, but you can see this thing going back and forth. So the flow turns on, and the whole thing kind of bends over elastically, and then he turns it off, and there's a bit of a recoil. So it's okay, so this one is different. We're not looking down on the biofilm, so the biofilm is looking downwards on it, and these are deformations, ripples in the biofilm, and there's a flow going this way. And these guys actually move.
1 meter per second.
The flow is going at 1 meter per second. Well, yeah, so he's got this is in a little reactor with flow going through quite fast. This is sped up greatly, so the time, the velocity of these guys is it would take hours to get across here. So, is there a clock on here? No. So this is actually much slower than the motion of these guys. But you see what looks like a kind of interface waves or something. It's hard to know exactly what they are from this movie, but I'll argue that these are real interface waves later.
So the bottom is fixed, but these are ripples in the biofilm? Is that what?
Yeah, so it's hard to know exactly what they are, but Paul claims that he can actually watch things that he says are on top go across here. I don't know how he does that, but later on I'll argue that that's what's actually going on. There's stuff moving along in the transmitter.
And did you have the frequency with it there, or did they, is the biofilm moving the proper frequency with that at all? Or
sorry?
Is he creating the proper frequency with the biofilm? Or do you have to show up with the
They will eventually. Yeah, it'll take a little time. About that too. So the idea of the previous movie, we're seeing elastic behavior. This looks like fluid behavior. So it would be good if you turned off the forcing, these guys would go away.
What's the arrow?
I'm not sure exactly what is mine. You see, there's some dark guys that are more dense. I should have pointed this out on the previous movie as well. These things don't look homogeneous. Maybe I'll show the previous movie again just to point that out. Some things that are darker, and they're obviously not moving, or at least moving much more slowly. If you actually follow them, they do look like they move a little bit.
I have a suggestion. When you have an old bacterial culture, they produce this mucus and polysaccharides and stuff, but then there are clumps of bacteria themselves, and they will usually look dark, and that's probably what that is.
Okay.
So that's just clump bacteria without much of anything else around.
It's quite possible, or at least more down. So this is, we're again looking down on a biofilm, and this is one of these those streamer things, in fact, we saw in a cartoon. And so what Paul does is he has a flow going and he turns it up. It's, things are nice and happy. He turns up the flow, the thing starts, and things start to happen. So we're happy now, he just turned up the flow speed. I can see that very well, maybe. And the thing stretches out and turns it down, but it's too late now. It's gonna pop off in just a second. So that's the kind of thing that I'd like to be able to do. Again, look how non-homogeneous that thing is. So we really want to talk about mechanics, but I ought to say something about at least one slide about resistance to chemical attack, because this is maybe the thing that people care about the most, biologists care about the most. It's very interesting. So these biofilms, they're very hard to get rid of, very resistant to everything that really that people have thrown at them. And why is that? Well, there are a lot of reasons. I'll mention a few here, some of the more mechanical. First of all, there's the matrix itself. Of course, these guys are embedded in this matrix. It's a pretty fine scale thing. The bacterial cells are 1 micron, so I don't really know much about what this matrix looks like, but it's got to be finer than 1 micron anyway. So anything bigger than that can't get in very easily. So that gets rid of big things, including parts of your immune system. Then there's also an interesting protection that I'll get into in more detail later, which is an active layer protection. So you have this layer of biofilm. The top of the biofilm is happy because it's close to nutrients, oxygen, whatever it needs, but the bottom of the biofilm is far away from that. Well, it's unhappy that it can't get to the nutrients, but that's also a good thing because if you attack the biofilm with something, if it's a reactive substance, it'll get used up in this active layer on top and won't actually make it down below. So that gets rid of quite a lot of things. And we'll also show you a picture of that. That's one of the successes of modeling, actually, something like that. And then there's something called a persister cell, which is not specific to biofilms. That's a very interesting thing. Is that actually visible? So let me talk a little bit about this for a few reasons that I'll mention. So what happened, of course, when people discovered antibiotics is the first thing they did is they took some bacteria and dumped antibiotics on it and looked at what happened. And what they saw is, of course, you put a lot of antibiotic in it, it kills a lot of stuff. But it didn't kill everything. Some things were able to resist this. And this has been kind of a mystery. People have known this for a long time. This is different from the resistant strains that you hear about in the news so much. These are just ordinary strains. You attack them with some biocide, like an antibiotic or something. Some stuff survives. You grow it up overnight, and the new colony looks just like the old colony. You can attack it again. Most stuff will be killed, but some stuff will survive. So it doesn't seem to be like a mutation thing, because it comes and goes pretty quickly. So it seems like a phenotypic problem. Now, I guess this is my microfluidics here. So recently, people have been doing some clever things with some of these etching devices. They've etched, so we have long channels here, and you can put a bacteria in it, it'll get stuck there, and you can't move around, and you can identify it and all its offspring, because it's all in the same channel. So it gives you it makes life a lot easier. So here's an experiment, a persister experiment from just a year or two back with this stuff. So this group, Balaban et al., took one of these things. They grew up some bacteria. This is not biofilm bacteria. It's just regular E. coli of some type. Then they hit it with ampicillin, I guess, which killed for a long time, you know, 7 hours. Killed almost everything, but not quite everything. So now they take the ampicillin away, and after a long time, stuff is growing. Here's a plot of the survival rate. So this is the ampicillin period over here. You can see there's an exponential decay, but then there's some leftover stuff. Well, it's still dying, but exponentially slower. It seems fairly resistant. The red curve is a mutant with more of these persisters in it. Here's another plot of persisters. An interesting thing about persisters. So this is from a Gilbert group. And he did the same thing. He took a population of E. coli, in fact, and dosed it with something tetracycline. That's this curve here. And then he took the survivors of this, and he gathered them up and dosed them with something, with other things. So these three curves: one is tetracycline again, one is ciprofloxacin, and one is something else. I don't know what that is. And the these guys were resistant to all of those, not just the original things. So
does the persister cells have genetic origin? They have certain mutation that allow them to be
No, because if you take these guys and grow them up overnight in a culture, the new culture you get look just like the old culture. It's, you know, mostly non-persisters, but more or less the same percentage of persisters as you started with.
The replication rate of persisters lower than of the normal type.
So it's hard to get people to agree, but that's one thing they seem to agree on, is that they're slower growing. So this is somehow related to slower growth means more tolerant to things. So in fact, so I mentioned this for a few things. One is this is my microfluid. And the other is that I started working with Bruce Ayadi on this. It's a product of this workshop. Based on an idea explained to me by Peter Gilbert, and I think we'll have a nice explanation, but I won't talk about it here. We'll have to ask about it. One last remark. So this is not really a problem so much, because if you knock out most of the bacterial cells, your immune system can deal hopefully with the remainder. But it could be a problem. It is a problem in biofilms, because those few remaining cells, they're protected in the matrix, and your immune system can't get to them. At least not in time, not before they have a chance to regrow.
Are these persister cells coated with, individually coated with something that's impervious?
There's no kind of information like that I know of that have any sense.
That's kind of what it sounds like. That's because the cells are the same, there's something special about them.
You can't see, in those microwave channels, you can't see any difference, so it's not.
Yeah, but you could look at an electron microscope.
Yeah, it could be done.
Has that been done?
Not that I know. So there's nothing visible like that. Okay, so let's get back to mechanics, which is really what I want to get into. So here are the kind of questions I'd like to have at least some intuition for. And that is, namely, how do biofilms respond to external stress, or internal stress for that matter? So you want to figure out what do you need to know about the physics and biology for this problem. And thinking of this guy as a material, then we want to go out and start measuring properties, elastic moduli, etc. Talk about that. Done quite a bit of that. And then somehow put this together into useful constitutive laws so that you can think about whatever particular problem you want to think about. So as I said before, the long-term goal here is why does a biofilm look like it does? And in fact, that's a really vague question, because I'm not even sure how to quantitatively say what a biofilm looks like. But intuitively, I think it's fairly clear what we want to do. So let me repeat that there's really two, I want to divide this into two pieces really. One is growth of the biofilm, and the other is decay somehow in the biofilm. It's maybe these things balance each other. Okay, a few remarks. So this picture is indicative really of our main contribution to this field, I think. Biofilms are viscoelastic fluids. This is a plot from a pretest taken from some particular biofilm. In this case, these guys went out into the forest and just took a chunk of thing out of something out of the stream. And so what this is the following. So I did put labels on this for some reason. This is time along the bottom. And so what we do is we have have some biofilm between two plates. We apply a stress to the top plate for the 360 seconds, 6 minutes in this case. And you see, and you just see how much the plate moves. And this axis is the measurement of how much the plate moves. Okay, so we apply a step stress from here to here. The first thing that happens is this guy jumps up, just like an elastic material would. And then, but you keep the stress on, and then it starts to do what's called creep along here. So, and that's just what a viscous fluid would do if you apply the stress to it. It would have this kind of linear motion to it, the viscosity. So it's got kind of, and I'll ignore that part because it's embarrassing for everyone to get to it. But, after you take the stress off, the guy, the biofilm is not a guy. Snaps back. This is, I mean, if you know some viscoelasticity, this is like a cartoon of a viscoelastic fluid almost. Let me mention one thing that's quite important here as well. If you imagine, there's a time scale implied in this graph. If you imagine doing this same experiment, but keeping the stress on for a very, very long time, so instead of 6 minutes, 6 hours or something, you wouldn't see this at all. You just see a straight line. It would look only like a viscous fluid. On the other hand, if we did the experiment for 6 seconds or 0.6 of a second or something, you wouldn't see any of this. You'd just see it jump up and down and look like a solid. So there's some time scale implied here that where you see both elastic fluid. And that's roughly called the elastic relaxation time, which is on the order of 10 minutes here. Okay. If you're shorter, much shorter than that, looks like a solid. Much longer than that, looks like a fluid. So that's very important if you want to know about mechanics. I'll get back to that later. A couple of other things. It turns out, I won't talk about this at all because I don't really know anything about it. Biofilms induce a lot of drag. These are 100 micron or so thick things. But even in a big pipe, they can produce drag of 20% or something like that. So that's kind of a big problem, and I don't know anybody who's actually working on it at the moment. So if somebody here has some ideas to do that, that would be interesting.
Why would that be interesting?
I don't know.
I mean, whether the boundary is there one biofilm away, or you still get the zero flow boundary condition as the surface.
One possibility is you have these streamers flapping away, and they're kind of emitting vorticity somehow into the flow. But I don't know. Okay, so where are we? All right. There are some other things that should be talked about, even in relation to mechanics, like signaling molecules, what do they do? There's speculation that I was talking about this the other day with somebody, that there are molecules that go around and cut up the EBS matrix. And so if you don't have active cells around to rebuild it, that can do things. So there are a lot of course, there are many, many other things that I won't get into. This is a very simple look. Okay, so let's start with, I'll call this unstressed biofilm, but what I mean is growth. And here's a little bit of math, actually. So this is my entry into this problem. I'll tell you why in a little bit. But the idea, so we want a simple model of how a biofilm grows. So what we have is a layer of biofilm, and above it, some water with nutrients in it. So somehow the nutrients diffuse down into the biofilm, and they get eaten, and the biofilm grows. So that's all that's here. So this is the equation for the nutrients. It's a diffusion equation. The biofilm grows very slowly compared to the diffusion time from more or less anything, so we can drop off the DDT term. So we have a quasi-equilibrium situation with diffusion balanced by RC is the eating function, how fast stuff gets eaten. And this is a non-dimensional form. G is some non-dimensional parameter, which measures how more or less how far a nutrient can get into the biofilm before it gets eaten. This water, in fact. One interesting thing to point out right away, we'll see in the next slide, I think. R of 0 is 0. If there's nothing there, the thing can't be eaten. For C small, this is proportional to C. And you see, and if you do a quick calculation, you'll see that you get exponential decay of C. So you get a very sharp boundary between where there's food and where there's not food. And that's the boundary between the active layer and the inactive layer. Okay, so we have this food, and then the next equation is telling us how the biofilm actually moves. So there's some pressure present, and so this is coming from growth. Biofilm is mostly water, so I'm going to decide that it's incompressible here. And so there's some pressure as more biofilm is growing, it's got to push out, and that's this equation here. Come back to this in a second. And to get this pressure, just take the divergence of this equation, as here, and the divergence of u is how fast stuff is growing, but that's some function of how much stuff is being eaten. Okay, so that gives you equation for pressure. Gives you velocity. The top of the biofilm grows like, well, just this guy at the normal, at the top times the normal. So a couple things, a little point, this extra parameter lambda doesn't actually matter because you can see here pressure is proportional to 1 over lambda, but then that means that u is independent of lambda, so that's at least one parameter we don't have to worry about. But the main thing I want to point out is this guy here. This is really quite a bogus thing to do, I think. This is the momentum equation here. This is the balance of forces. So we've got growth of biofilm that's pushing outwards. Something's got to attack and get back against that force which is pushing outwards. We have to have something. In this case, I just put in a friction term, just because I don't know what else to do. Well, not here yet. I'll get back to that. And in fact, what other people have done is
looks like Darcy's law.
That's Darcy's law, yeah. I prefer to think of a friction, because I say it's Darcy's law when people start asking me questions about force. Okay. So first, 1D solutions, and these are quite old, dating back to the 80s. Well, I guess that's not really old. Anyways. But predate my involvement in this anyways. You can easily solve those equations in 1D. What we're interested in is the height of the biofilm, h of t. So that's given, this is the PDN at the top, which is something like this. And you can read off a lot of information, even if you don't really know what g and r are. You can see, well, if h is small, then this integral is order h. So you have h dot is something times h exponential growth. If h is large, well, we have this active layer, so g is really non-zero only in a certain area. So this integral is basically a constant. And you get h dot is a constant in linear growth. And these are things that actually match up well with the experiment, as well as the other things here. Here's the remark about the active layer. So t has this penetration depth of order g to the minus 1/2, and then it decays exponentially. By the way, this is not only for nutrient, but anything else that's reactive or depends on reactive things, it will have the same behavior. I'll show you an example in an interesting experiment in a second. Illustrate that. Okay, this is a picture of an active layer taken from the lab of Phil Stewart. This is a biofilm. The bottom is here. The top is here. The whole thing was stained red, and then the active, metabolically active part was counterstained green or yellow, whatever that is. And you can see this very nice sharp layer at the top.
How many bacterial diameters is that active layer?
Actually, I don't know what the thickness of this is. I would guess on the order of 10, but that's a guess. Just thinking that this is about 100.
What about the metabolites? The bacteria, does it get out?
Well, that's another question. Down here, they don't get out so easily. Maybe they're doing things too. So this was actually a precursor, I think, to an interesting experiment where what he did is they grew a biofilm on agar infused with some antibiotic from down here. And this was air up here in that case. And so the limiting nutrient there was oxygen coming from up here. The biocide was down here. Where are things going to be killed? Well, it turned out all the killing was up here, biocide diffused all the way through up to the top, but did nothing down here because this stuff was inactive. It just killed stuff off the top. So that's a very good illustration of the protective effect. Okay. I don't know how much I want to get into this. So if you look at these 1D solutions, this is where I got into this. People are doing a lot of cellular automata type stuff and looking at this, some version of that system I showed you before, and getting all these bumpy things. And I didn't really understand it too well, so we wrote down the continuum system, which was more understandable, except for this stuff about Darcy's Law. And if you look at a 1D flat biofilm, you see that it's unstable. It's pretty easy to think about this. You have stuff diffusing in from the top, biofilm is growing up. If you get a bump, it's closer to the food, so it's happier, so it grows more, and it gets bumpy. That's the Mullins perfect stability. So let's look at these details. And here's a movie done by Eric, a nice calculation by Eric. There are these different colors. This is actually a multi-species version of what I showed you. This will grow forever, I think, because there's nothing here to stop it from growing. And biofilms don't grow forever. So, but you didn't want to worry about that at that time. A lot of people have done these kind of things, by the way. Pitcher Rainey is really the famous guy for cellular automata and individual based models, but a lot of other people have done as well. Nick Kogan has done some.
In the one
side,
you're not actually solving exteriors
for biofilm. That's important. Actually, you have the diffusion equation for the substrate for the food is also solved outside. You have to have a boundary layer for that, so that these guys are happier to stick up. If you just have a constant food, then it doesn't help you to stick up into the food layer. So that's important.
I was just thinking, presumably if you solved it in a closed box, it wouldn't grow forever because
you've
got out of nutrient in the top.
Yeah, you could starve it and it'll stop growing, or it could just run out of space. But that's not really how biofilms go away. Okay, so I want to spend at least a few minutes talking about the following thing, which I've been thinking about more recently. So we have this growing biofilm being pushed out. Something has to balance that pushing force. What should it be? So I really like the physicist's way of thinking about these kind of things, which is you have some system, you plop down an energy, and you minimize it and see what kind of structure you got. So I thought we'd try to do something like that here. And it goes like this. So this is actually partly following what Nick Kogan did in his thesis. So we have two phases now. One is biomaterial stuff, without saying specifically what that is. The rest of the stuff, the rest of the material is water, basically. Okay, and so we look at this biomaterial and we write down an energy that looks like this. So this is 5B equals 0, no biomaterial. This is 5B equals 1, everything is biomaterial. This is a volume fraction. And we say, well, the stuff is sticky, it wants to stick together somehow. So as you increase the biomaterial, energy goes down. And then, it wants to be hydrated too. So if there's too much biomaterial, it doesn't like that. I don't really care so much about what's going on over here in more inches than in this half of the graph anyways. Okay. And an important thing is there's a inflection point here. So the idea is that if the biomaterial is too far apart so the polymers can't communicate somehow, then the energy falls off rapidly. So you get this kind of thing. So particularly, this is the energy we write down. F is what I just showed you on the previous slide. And then we add in this regularization thing, which if someone could give me a good physical explanation for that, I'd be happier than I am now. But we need it for mathematical reasons, too. This just penalizes sharp variation, which is probably reasonable. But
what's five?
Kind of surface
what's
tension.
Five?
What's this guy?
Yeah, five.
That's the volume fraction of biomaterial? Kappa is some parameter.
Kappa kind of typically becomes proportional to surface tension, I think, right?
Yeah.
If you generate a lot of interface between the two phases, it's penalized.
So the size of the surfaces is goes like kappa or square root of kappa or something, so kappa will tell you something about the surface energy.
But if it's aerobic, like you implied earlier a couple slides ago, then having more surface would be a good thing for them.
Yeah, I should have mentioned, by the way, one of the reasons people like these mushrooms is they said, well, biofilms must like that because it increases the surface area. But it turns out if you do the calculations, you actually get less oxygen or whatever when it's bumpier, because the stuff has to diffuse in and around. To get to the extra surface, it has to diffuse in and around and down, and it takes longer to do that. So it actually hurts you a little bit.
This is for still atmosphere around?
Well, no, anything. Water, air. Depends a little bit on your boundary conditions, but basically it's anything.
Is that the Collins thesis, what you just said?
No, this is older stuff.
Isn't that going to be a difference between a continuum and a discrete model? Because if you're just solving the diffusion equation, then in your continuum case, you're going to get a smooth surface, and if you have discrete, since you get the DLA-like structure in the absence of surface tension.
The rough, so we didn't have surface tension in the previous calculations. If you know those kind of instabilities, you think that they may be ill-posed to that, but actually this active layer, having a whole layer of growth smooths that out. But in answer to your question, the Sawyer Tom people just have the same answer. The roughness actually decreases.
Well, I guess it's going to depend on the form of your growth as a function of oxygen concentration, whether you get a...
Not that I know of. It does depend somewhat on how you, on your boundary conditions on the oxygen. If you put them very close to the new supply of oxygen very close to your biofilm, then it's good to have a lot of surface area because things don't have to diffuse well, right? It's far away than
you. At some level, you can only absorb as much as it's coming by your diffusion, so just locally increasing the surface very wildly is not going to get anywhere. Because
exactly.
There's not much in
fact, it's the opposite. It has a longer journey. You know? Okay. So let me go through this relatively quickly. You take this energy, and it varies, of course, if you start moving 5D around. So that does some work, and that gets you some term in the momentum equation, this guy. We have a frictional coupling again, and this is what people use. I'd be happier if someone could explain why that is. It's sort of based on Stokes drag, but it's kind of a rough thing. And then other terms, which I'll throw out here. By the way, the whole point of this is to balance growth versus this energy, but I drop growth to start with just to see what this guy will do. So we have to come in and add growth in later on. Okay, so let me, for the mathematically inclined, let me just mention, you do some algebra. Here's where the growth got dropped here. That should be a growth term. And you get this Kahn-Hilliard equation, almost, with these alphas. It'll look like this. This is what keeps your volume fraction between 0 and 1. So quite a lot is known about these guys. So the first thing we want to do is suppose you have a bunch of biofilm. What kind of spontaneously form a film, actually? Is it going to be happy doing that? It wants to stick together, we hope, and so we hope we get this nice film. We're looking for solutions that look like this. These are walls here. Dotted lines. And if you look for steady solutions, you let this thing find the energy minimum or something. These are the possibilities. There's an easy phase plane analysis, but I'll skip it in the interest of time. So what we want to do is, if we kind of pull these walls apart somehow, so the amount of biofilm goes down, eventually at some point it's going to say, I want to be something like this. This is not actually that calculation exactly. So this is time starting from zero and increasing. This is our one spatial dimension. The one, by the way, the one dimension here is the vertical dimension from the wall. We start with a uniform biofilm attached to the two walls, but with a little bit of a perturbation, and it'll snap off. In this case, right at the wall, it doesn't have to do that. It's a nice film shape. So that's what we
the region where the pH has dropped to zero, that's all solvent.
Sure.
The,
yeah, so these guys actually drop right down to zero.
And is this the other area one or something close to one?
No, no.
Or
yeah. So I mean, there's a fixed amount.
Yeah, that
of
was
stuff
0.5 when you started.
And it doesn't go up to one. Actually, if you remember the energy curve, there's a minimum someplace away from one. But this isn't even at that minimum. It doesn't even go that minimum actually. But that's a longer story.
Why does it snap up left and over to right?
It can snap left, right, or in the middle. It just depends on what the perturbation looks like. It's easy to do a linear analysis of this thing, by the way. It's easier to do that if you're in periodic boundaries. So this is a slightly different story. This is, we want to get out this clumpiness of biofilm. You start with a uniform biofilm. If it's not sufficiently dense, so it's not happy enough, the volume fraction is too low, wants to be higher, it may actually decide to take biofilm from over here, bring it closer by, so you get a denser guy with lower energy, or I should say higher volume fraction with lower energy. Of course, the trade-off is that over here, things are less, the volume fraction is smaller, so the energy has gone up there. But if things are right, then we'll decide to do that. And this is, by the way, it's been observed a lot, but actually quantified recently. Okay, so now what we're looking for, these are periodic solutions now. We want this guy to turn into something, well, one of these guys. Volume fraction in this direction, so we get a variation of volume fraction. Here's, unfortunately, time is the opposite direction here, so we start on this side with a uniform biofilm of sufficiently low volume fraction with a little bit of a perturbation that turns into these clumpy dots. By the way, these things are probably not, it looks like it's nice and stable, they're probably not actually stable, but that's a longer story. They're stable for a while, long enough for us. Okay, so I pretty much pulled this out of thin air, this energy. I want to get some experimental evidence for this, or at least some measurements of what it might be. And so hopefully that will happen, but it's hard to get people to do this sort of thing. There's a guy who's doing some micropipette experiments where he pulls on a bit of biofilm from the two ends and sees how hard he has to pull on it to get this guy to snap apart, so that would be useful. I want to make sure that I thank the UNC Virtual Lung Group. So I've been on sabbatical this year and spent the fall at Chapel Hill working on microbead geometry, and they have a great group there. If you saw the talk yesterday from Rich, that's just the tip of the iceberg. A lot of good things are going to come out of there. I think they've really solved a lot of the problems of communicating between mathematicians and physicists and biologists. So that's very exciting. Anyhow, so microbead geometry hopefully will get us a way to look locally at properties. So we'll get some stuff from that soon. Okay. Boy. Okay, so let me make some remarks about this. There are a ton of these models that I've the type I've shown you. Of course, I showed you mine because I'm the speaker, so I get to do that. There are a lot of other ones as well. But however, for 1D we're okay, but for higher dimensions, there's really not been much comparison with lab data because the people in labs generally grow their biofilms under fluid shear stress. And that completely changes the picture of what things will look like. So we don't really know whether these are good models or not. So we've got to include that. The other thing is that, back to this question, what you have growth causes things to expand. What makes a stationary biofilm? Well, chunks of stuff coming off is maybe the main reason. That for that, you need to know what the fluid shear stress is doing, because that's what's responsible there. Okay. So let me skip some of this stuff. I want to mention this graph, which I'm very proud of. This is maybe, I think, the most interesting thing in this whole talk. And this is a balance. This is a plot for a whole bunch of different kind of bacteria biofilms. All these guys, if you know something about bacteria more than I, will know that there are different types of some grown in the lab, some not, some mucus, some not. And what we do is we plot, so we measured their, we did these creep curves I showed you before, and from that you can extract elastic modulus and viscosity, and we plot them against each other, and it turns out they're linearly proportional to each other, to a very good approximation. Notice the huge range in these guys, by the way, and especially the viscosity of the viscous. The viscosity of water is, I think, in these units, something like 10 to the minus 2, so these are hugely viscous compared to water.
Does that have something to do with hydration?
The viscosity?
Yeah.
Sorry, if you're asking if you make it more hydrated, how does it change? Yeah, I don't know.
Does the external fluid?
It's very possible. But I don't know the answer to that question. Okay, so the ratio of these guys turns out to be roughly that elastic relaxation time that I was talking about before. So what this plot is saying, that all these different biofilms have very different properties, elastic properties, but their elastic relaxation times are all about the same, 20 minutes, well, sort of 10 to 100 minutes, really, which is a very interesting thing by itself, but I won't go into it because we're running out of time. But it's also very helpful if you're modeling. So now you know if you're looking at things that are less than 10 minutes, you should treat this as an elastic body. If it's more than 10 minutes, it's a viscous fluid. A very viscous fluid. Okay, so let me go quickly to, this is a very nice calculation done by Zhaohai. Again, this is a product of the workshop here. What we have is two layers. On top is water. On the bottom is biofilm, more viscous by 10 to the 6, factor 10 to the 6 or something in the water. So this is a very hard calculation to do because of that jump. It's more or less impossible unless you are very careful. So we've been working on a way to do that, and I plotted, we don't have movies yet, unfortunately, but I plotted a snapshot of the velocity in the biofilm, and you can see, so these are kind of snapshot streamlines. You can see these guys are indicating waves. These bumps are going to move along. Something like.
What's the green on top, water?
On top is water. I didn't plot anything in there, so you can see the bottom. Okay, so.
Sorry, the streamlines of water going through the biofilm, or is the biofilm
itself? This is biofilm itself as
exactly.
A viscous fluid. So this is over a long time. We're thinking of this as a fluid. So you see these waves moving.
What happens when it gets sketched?
It's periodic.
No, I mean the streamlines that just
suddenly. Oh, this thing is moving. So the velocity of the bump is actually like that.
How does the wavelength compare to the depth of the biofilm?
Well, we don't have movies, so we don't know what's going to happen to these guys yet. So.
But even in this picture, is the scaling in Y different from X?
Oh, no, sorry. Stokes flow on the top and bottom, in this case, actually, snapshot at a particular time. So, by the way, if there's any mathematicians here who want to talk about fluids and kind of missing some of that, so I'm happy to talk about that. Okay, so the next thing we did is we want to look at short times. We have elastic biofilm, put stress on it with a flow across the top. What does it do? So to do this, we used a very nice, simple method, which will be familiar to some of you, called the immersed boundary method. And since I'm more or less out of time, I won't go into it all very much. But the idea is you discretize the biofilm into chunks that are attached by springs, some generalized springs here. And those produce a force on the fluid. So you put a force in for those guys, and these are the chunks of biofilm that move along according to the fluid, and you kind of embed the whole thing into one big fluid. So you don't have to keep track of this nasty interface. Okay, so here's that. So here are some snapshots. The yellow stuff is biofilm, of course. This is done by Eric. So this is, again, very recent work, so it's not completed. What we have here is the top wall is set in motion. At some time, or I guess it's already going, and it increases, and then it's turned off. And so you see the fluid shear velocity, shear is increasing down here. Some interesting stuff is happening, then it's turned off. And now the elastic, this is the elastic recoil. So the valve is doing some things. What we want to do, what we're working on right now, is to calibrate our springs against our rheometry data. We have a ton of rheometry data. We're using, at the moment, Jeffrey's fluid for a reason I won't go into at the moment because we're out of time, but you can ask me about. And we can actually perform computational rheology. So here's an example. This is all biofilm. These are the little dots are the biofilm connected by these red springs. The plate at the top is moving, and the color is some measure of stress as the thing gets deformed. Now it's looking back. Okay, so the idea is we'll fit this to our rheometry data. And actually, we're hoping to learn something about the rheometry data as well from the universe for this stuff. Okay, so here's a nice picture. Nice movie, rather. You can cut these springs if they get too stretched. That's what we'll do here, or that's here. So again, the top of the box is moving, producing a shear flow, which is pulling this guy out. This is kind of imitation of Paul Stubley's picture of this mushroom here. It gets stretched out, and it's ripped off of the bottom, actually. That's where the shear is biggest. And boom. It's about to go. It's periodic conditions here.
It's periodic.
Okay. And I think one last movie. So we couldn't design our own microfluid channels, but